A very warm welcome to Michael Burda. He's American. He studied in Harvard and in Göttingen. Since 1993, he's been professor at Humboldt University in Berlin. His special area of expertise is macroeconomics, particularly labor economics. In addition, he's also the head of the European Economic Association, which brings together also economists in the German-speaking world. And as far as I know, you've been doing your best to improve the rather poor image of economists so that they're presented in a rather fairer and more balanced way. Now, as you may have noticed, the idea is that some texts were given to us by the person that we were going to put questions to so we would know what was going on. So Mr. Burda made it really easy peasy for me, almost too easy. He gave me an excerpt from his textbook on macroeconomics, the chapter on credits. There's a text box there. And it ends with the following words. This brings me to my question. By the way, I've only got two questions, but the second question is going to be divided up into three partial questions, just so you know. So the first question, the last paragraph of this text. Ultimately, we see that this fundamental truth emerges that there are credit markets because there are advantages arising from trade. The reasons from this line, the varying degree of patience at different needs, different possibilities, and differing degrees of information. So the fundamental truth is that there are credit markets because there are advantages from the market. In other words, you don't need to worry too much about credit markets somehow being very different from standard markets, such as labor markets or product markets. But as is the case for all markets, action is taken when both the parties involved can derive advantage from the action taken. Different interests, because people have different resources, different interests. And there's one thing that's a little different here. What we're looking at is a different degree of patience. Patience is the temporal factor which enters into play here. Patience is something that assumes that the aim is fixed. Some are less patient, others are more patient. Would you say that the dimension of granting loans and accepting credit is really sufficiently modeled? Well, I didn't say that all of these markets can be represented precisely one-to-one labor markets. I just said that one of the key reasons why people take out a loan or a credit is because they're a bit impatient. I listened to the last two presentations. How could I make this all a bit more tangible for people? I took a look at what our Berlin airport's going to cost. Still not finished. It was supposed to cost 4.5 billion euros. Now, I wondered what it would mean if all Berliners had to pay for this airport directly, just like that. And actually, it wouldn't work. In fact, it wouldn't even work if the whole Federal Republic of Germany were in one fell swoop to have to finance this airport. So by our yardsticks, in terms of the things that we want to do, we want to rebuild the Berlin City Palace. The German Reichstag has been rebuilt. Billions have been sunk in the Brandenburg sand in this airport. There's all kinds of projects that have got bogged down, but they're all projects that you can't afford in one fell swoop, but we're all a little more impoverished. If we don't have them, it's no good. If you don't have an airport, Germans in particular are very keen to jet off on the holidays, so we want an airport. So the more that we need to drum up the resources that we can pay them now so that now we can fly off to Tenerife. Somehow or other, people in society need to arrange themselves to make it possible to do this. That's why there's a loan market, a credit market, if you want to buy a house rather than rent a flat. You say, well, I want a house now. No dispute about that. Well, let me finish, because I want to make this clear. People don't get this. Now, 4.5 billion, that's what you need to pile up. And somebody who administers this also has power. I think that's reprehensible. So one man, two women, whatever. A bunch of people can shove this money back and forth, but that's the way it is. They can mobilize this money. It's not just bankers, other people, hedge fund managers, for example, people who sell life and manage life insurance funds and run pension funds. They've got a great deal of responsibility. And if they don't act in the common good, there are problems. So it doesn't function perfectly. We need to really keep a careful eye on what they're doing. We didn't do that in Berlin, nor did our dear Lord Mayor. It was actually his job, wasn't it? As a matter of fact, the supervisory board for the airport should also have taken a look at the funding. If that doesn't happen, then there's problems. In the financial crisis, there was a heap of such problems. My country is perhaps the most responsible. We really are the ones who are responsible. We created these innovations that never existed before, all these securities lumped together. And there were the Europeans who were very patient and funded all of this. The Europeans largely purchased these bonds to fund the enormous expenses in the States. So that was what I had to say to you for today. Now, if you look at your textbook, you'll see there's a relationship between consumption today and consumption tomorrow. So a person or a state can decide either to consume now or in the future. The difference relates to interest rates. Is it possible to earn more than the interest rate or not? If you can, then you should take on this risk. For example, you've argued that in the future, the airport will produce income. And therefore, it seems to make sense to spend that money. But during the period in which the loan is granted, there's things that happen that are unpredictable. I mean, quite irrespective of fraud, embezzlement, or whatever. Is it possible to create a model for this? This is an introductory textbook. I wouldn't say that we're talking about this in terms of introductory textbook, but what could you do to ensure that it's really dealt with properly? Well, that's a great question. Of course, loans are based on events that we cannot really know about. We all imagine that in 10 years' time, Berlin will be a great success, and young people from around the world will come to Berlin to party, do business, and pay taxes. Berlin will be swimming in cash and be able to pay back its debts. That's one expectation. That's one scenario. Berlin in the 1890s was a real boom town. That's a different scenario. You could fund everything. They funded the S-Bahn, the mass transit system, through taxes, everything. But remember, we've totally missed the mark, and therefore we need to correctly represent and depict the probabilities to the best of our knowledge to see what's possible and what is really completely over the top when we're being persuaded of something which is simply not possible. I go for a rather more modest airport rather than a megalomaniac project, because you really might end up regretting it afterwards. Think of Frankfurt, for example. And Frankfurt is extending for the third time. So it's all shaped through expectations when you buy a new car. The Germans are very careful. They don't rush to get credit. They tend to invest abroad rather than take and lend to others rather than taking out loans themselves. But people do think very carefully about the future. If they don't, well, either you have moral hazard or you haven't had due diligence. You can't really include entrepreneurs here because most startups do this with their own cash or with family money, money that you'd be spending anyway. It's not debt, it's an investment, it's something different. Debt's something different. When you can stipulate this in a contract, as in The Merchant of Venice, you'll get your pound of flesh. That's something else. And there are countries where this is not acceptable. I don't want to quibble with all of this, but we need to distinguish between debt and risk capital. They're two different things. My second question. In your textbook, you refer to Robinson Crusoe. We've had Daniel Defoe today already, haven't we? He invented this kind of Robinson Crusoe utopia. And you and your co-author use this figure. It's so helpful because you have the producer, the consumer, and the government all rolled into one. It's also a figure which is, doesn't have any ties, no bonds. On the island, coconut trees, coconut palms, every day the same, and Robinson can take his decisions. Is that something which could be presented in a more complex way in future models, or would you stick to that? Well, not if you're sensible. We do this as a means of teaching, to teach certain things. There's some things that people who have no contact to economics really understand about. What's interest? What's compound interest? Yes, real interest rate. What exactly does that mean? I've been wondering about that myself. Sleepless nights over it. No, really, that's an honest question. Oh, now everybody's really interested in this, aren't they? Well, what that means is the following. Oh, it's tricky to explain this, actually. If you live in a world like in Germany where you've got 2% inflation, but normally you have to always reckon that prices will increase. And if you're lucky and you keep your job, your wages will increase, at least at the same rate as prices. Trade unions will ensure that that's the case, which is a good thing. They might even want a little more because workers have become more productive. And if that's the case, then, for example, 9% interest for a car because, well, let me explain. If you have a 2 to 3% increase in wages per annum, then 9% is really not that bad. Your wages will come up to that level of 9%. Even if you're giving a loan, 9% is not such a great deal. Many Germans and Austrians put money in Hungary. They thought, Hungary, 9%. Iceland, 11% interest. Yippee, let's do it. And then all of a sudden, there's inflation in Iceland, depreciation of the Icelandic currency, and they've lost the lot. So you need to think in rational terms. So the real interest rate, in a sense, deducts the inflationary expectation, or it preempts, rather, the inflationary expectation. Inflationary expectations are rather moderate, but in the 70s, for example, even in Germany, you had inflation rates of 5, 6, 7%. It does happen. And people look to the future and preempt this. So they take a pedagogical approach, let's say. Let's say we'll be entirely cautious. And once the students have got a bit more mature, we assume that they can go along with a more complex situation. Well, couldn't you say we'll start with completely groping in the dark, complete ignorance. We don't know how the future will look. There's one instrument which helps a little to look into the future. And then on the basis of that, we'll gradually, carefully, incrementally create these kind of mechanisms. And then it was something which asymptotically moves cautiously closer to the future. Would that be a possibility for the next textbook? Well, you'd frighten off a whole load of students with that. Reflecting this situation, well, not knowing anything. You know nothing. You're in the mist, in the fog. I don't know whether you're going to the north or to the south. And I think that that's something which would rather discourage me. Economists believe, Hayek said this as well, by the way, economists believe that prices have a clarifying and informative function. They're not truths per se. They process information. They're machines. They're mechanisms. Any activity leads to a change in the price. That information is transmitted to me and to you. Well, the prices are a signal which we can use to guide us as we're swathed in this fog. Well, yes, but to understand these signals, it would be better not to be swathed in fog. But you're quite right when you say, of course, you completely forget about being swathed in fog. These credit conditions I described are related to bankers who are responsible. My uncle was a banker, actually, in West Texas. He lent money to cotton farmers. And he used to say that back then there were a lot of unsecured credits. And he said he could do this as a banker because he looked people in the eyes. And a good banker should know without a calculator on the desk that whether a chap's a rascal or not. And that was the idea 100 years ago. Of what a banker was meant to be. Somebody who had a feeling for people and they're all sitting there in front of computer terminals doing all kinds of other stuff, lots of maths. But they've become a bit remote from this psychological side of things, this capacity to praise somebody up, to see how trustworthy you are. Well, isn't it the case that one instrument's been replaced by another? Your uncle was in a small moment. Well, actually, your uncle retired. Yeah, okay. But when he was working, he knew how people around him would work, the usual suspects, what they do. In a more complex, more anonymous world, we need different instruments, and thus, slowly but surely, you develop this kind of oversight. But it's not something which exists right from the very beginning. Wouldn't it make more sense when you're addressing these credit issues in the textbook and you talk about intertemporality? But there isn't anybody there who's providing a credit. Friday's not there, is he? Well, yes, okay. But more as a worker, Friday as somebody granting a credit. Well, that would be a new way of looking at things. Might that be a way of giving him a different status? Well, yes, that's a good idea. We could do that. This is a very important point, actually. The creditor should really look at their own situation and should never assume that the state will get them out of a pickle. And we shouldn't let things get to that state either. So people should ensure that the banks behave responsibly and never end up in a situation where they can get bailed out, hand over their debts to the states. For example, Greece and the non-private sector holders of debt, let's say. I mean, I'm not trying to put Greece in the stock, but what you were saying relates to Germany as well. Germany shoved a load of credits to Greece to fund things that we think are perhaps not so great. Armaments expenditure in Greece, for example, or defense systems against Turkey. I mean, they're all both supposed to be members of NATO, aren't they? Anyway, you have to look at the creditors and at the debtors as well. My last question. Traffic light's already gone amber. The question is, in the following quote, is there a pinch of irony or not? The seventh chapter on credits and loans ends with the following sentence. As I've already said, time should be divided into two periods, today and tomorrow. Tomorrow is a metaphor for the future. The day after tomorrow, Crusoe will be saved and won't need to bother about the economics of his island any longer. Well, yes, we'll all be in heaven, won't we? Well, that's a very good word to wind up on this journey, this odyssey, which has really taken us a long way. Thank you.